Bill, scandalized. He started to pack.
Just wait until I get my hands on him. He'll wish he'd never been born.
Children can't move that fast, mused Belindis, gathering her things. It must have been a gnome or a kobold or... Tungdil raised his hands to his head in sudden understanding.
Of course! Bislipo's gnome!
They hurried out of the room and down the stairs. Sverd must have followed us and waited for the opportunity to land us in real trouble. Bislipo's behind it all.
You can't fault the gnome's persistence,
said Bavrogor admiringly, tugging on the straps of his pack.
To think he followed us all this way. It would have been easy enough to track us,
argued Boindil. He peered into the front room of the tavern before waving the others on.
Not necessarily,
countered Belindis, impressed by Sverd's tenacity. He must have snuck his way into the Firstling Kingdom and found his way into the tunnels. That takes some doing. Remember the buckle we found in the runaway wagon?
Tungdil tiptoed to the door and scanned the street.
I knew I recognized it from somewhere.
He slipped out of the tavern with Boindil at his side.
We're safe, he said. They're searching another street.
You mustn't run,
Boindil told Goimgar.
Running in the middle of the night only attracts attention. They'll assume you're a criminal.
The travelers proceeded at a leisurely pace, chatting and smiling as if they were out for a nighttime stroll. Nothing in their behavior suggested they were engaged in illicit activity or fleeing a murder scene. Jeroen stayed in the shadows, trying to keep a low profile. Before they could reach the gates, a group of guards approached on a routine patrol.
Remember, Goimgard, just stay calm, whispered Boindil.
Shush,
hissed Belindis, with one eye on the trembling artisan.
You're only making things worse.
The guards were getting closer and had almost drawn level when a thin voice piped up.
Arrest the villains! Those are the culprits! Arrest them, guards! They're getting away!
That blasted gnome! I'll wring his scrawny neck!
Growled Ironheart, whipping out his axes to defend himself. The bewildered guardsmen looked to their leader for direction. Just then, the captain of the first patrol burst onto the street, shouting orders for their arrest. Candles blazed in the windows, shutters were opened, and the city awoke from its slumber.
We don't have time for explanations, said Andokai, drawing her sword. They won't believe us and will rot in their dungeons.
So what do we do?
Demanded Bavrogor, gripping the haft of his hammer, ready to fight his way out of the gates.
It's probably best if I slip away now,
said Rodario, shouldering his precious bag of costumes and hastily taking his leave.
I'll see you outside the city. I don't want to get in your way.
He hurried into a side street before the guards could surround them.
Never trust an actor.
Narmora grinned and pulled out her weapons. Tungdil held up his axe, pole first.
Don't kill unless you have to, he instructed them. We're leaving Rudacre, whether they like it or not.
Tungdil couldn't help noticing that their opponents were woefully underprepared. More accustomed to chasing purse snatchers and incarcerating drunks, the guards had little experience with combat and stood no chance of restraining four staunch dwarves, a maegar, a half-elf, and a giant. Fergus wasn't much of a warrior, but he held his ground valiantly and cleared enough space for Narmora to swing her weapons unimpeded. Goimgar was tasked with guarding the rest of the Ingots. After the shortest of skirmishes, they hurried to the gates, where Rodario was conversing with a guard. The whole company descended on the distracted sentry before he could sound the alarm. When he eventually noticed the maegar, it was already too late.
"You will let us through," she intoned. "You will let us through and tell no one that we passed this way."
Even as she spoke, the sentry's eyes glazed over and he raised the portcullis without a word.
"Didn't I do well?" the impresario said to Andokai. I bewitched his senses with my silvery speech, thus enabling the estimable maegar to cast her spell. Magic certainly has its uses. I don't suppose you'd consider a spot of backstage conjuring. Together we could put on a spectacle of such...
Fergus shook his head despairingly.
For pity's sake, Rodario.
There's no harm in asking. We need to earn a living somehow when our amazing adventure is at an end.
Bavrogor laughed.
Assuming you survived that long.
Buffeted by the wind, the
the rising portcullis made enough of a racket to wake the other sentries, whom Boindil attacked with enthusiasm. He stuck to using his pole as instructed, but Tungdil detected the sound of splintering bone.
He's desperate to finish them off.
He looked in consternation at the bloodied and oddly misshapen face of a sentry. The man keeled over as Ironheart landed a follow-up blow. With at least one dead, the company would be wanted for multiple murder as well as theft. Meanwhile, the portcullis was still rising slowly, but Sverd had followed them and was hiding in an alleyway, preparing to alert the guards a second time.
They're escaping! The murderers are escaping through the gates!
Even the last determined sleepers in the city were torn from their slumber by his shouts. Everyone with two legs and a weapon found their way onto the street, including the first courageous members of the militia, who came running out of their houses, having barely stopped to dress.
"Do something, Andokai!"
shouted Tungdil, terrified of what would happen to the citizens of Rudacre if the battle-crazed Boindil was to rampage through the city.
"We won't be able to hold them off!"
This time she didn't turn to sorcery.
"Jerun!"
she barked, and issued an unintelligible order. The giant stepped forward. The torches of the assembled crowd bathed his armor in flickering light, bringing the threatening visor to life. At that moment, the helmet produced a noise unlike anything Tungdil had heard in his life. It was a cross between a reptilian hiss and the dull, ponderous rumble of an earthquake, a sound so full of aggression and menace that anyone in earshot knew instantly not to approach. Tungdil felt the hairs on his neck stand on end. He took a nervous step back. Inside the helmet, the violet glow intensified, streaming out of the eyeholes and outshining the torches. The horrified faces of the transfixed crowd were steeped in a purple light that was painful to behold. The second roar was even louder and more terrifying than the first. This time everyone, including the guardsmen, turned in panic and fled, running back through the streets and alleyways to safety. The portcullis was almost fully raised.
"Let's go,"
stuttered Tungdil, still shaken by the sound of Jerun's voice.
Assuming it was his voice.
They ran into the night, glancing over their shoulders as they hurried down the snowy road. No one followed. The giant's performance had made enough of an impression to dissuade the townspeople from hunting them down. As for Tungdil, he was more curious than ever about the armored warrior, although he suspected the truth would be less than reassuring.
"It's not a human at any rate," he decided.
The company jogged in silence through the snow. After a while, Bavragor, who had fallen in line behind Goimgar, pointed to the artisan's back.
"Where are the ingots?"
he panted breathlessly, listening in vain for a response.
"Hey, I asked you a question."
Goimgar sped up, intent on getting far enough ahead before he dared to answer.
"I lost them," he said plaintively. "A guardsman knocked the bag from my hand and I couldn't reach it in the scrum. I'm sorry. I honestly didn't mean to."
"Didn't mean to? I'll give you didn't mean to, you worthless little—"
Bavragor lunged at him, but was restrained by Tungdil from behind.
"It's all right, Bavragor."
The mason was beside himself. His chestnut eye glinted angrily.
"All right! We've lost every single one of the ingots! We can't exactly fetch them now!"
"We'll be in the Fifthling Kingdom before you know it. We're bound to find something there," said Tungdil in a firm, confident voice that reminded everyone that he was the leader. To his mind, the matter was closed.
"But you said we shouldn't rely on finding materials on the way,"
Bavragor objected stubbornly.
"So why—"
"What's done is done,"
Tungdil said sharply.
"We'll have to make the best of things."
He loosened his hold on Bavragor and clapped him on the back. "No matter what happens, we're not going to let it stop us. We can't. No one else is going to forge the axe and save Gerdlegard. It's up to us."
"It will be a darn sight easier without Goimgar," grumbled Bavragor. "He only drags us down."
"Vrakus must have made him part of this mission for a reason."
Tungdil noticed that the mason was wheezing.
"Steady on, Bavragor. You'd better stop talking before you get a stitch. Goimgar's fitter than you."
"Cowards always make good runners."
Even as he spoke, there was a jangling noise and he stiffened. Before he could take another step, his legs buckled and he toppled over, raising a cloud of glistening snow. When the flakes settled, he was buried beneath a layer of white crystals. Sticking out of his neck was a bolt fired from a crossbow. The others, with the exception of Jeroen, threw themselves to the ground so as not to fall victim to the archer. Once again, Andukai barked an unintelligible command, whereupon the giants scanned their surroundings and set off at a sprint.
It definitely wasn't an elf, thought Tungdil.
Unlike Jeroen, he could see no sign of their hidden assailant.
Guardsmen? But guardsmen carry torches.
The Maegar crawled through the snow to examine the mason's wound. Belindis wriggled over to join her.
The tip stopped just short of his spine,
said Andukai, after a cursory inspection. If it weren't for his cloak and the metal-plated nape of his helmet, it would have penetrated farther. She gripped the shaft of the bolt resolutely and pulled it from his flesh. With her right hand, she stemmed the blood from the wound.
I hope he'll forgive me for using my dastardly magic to save his life.
She closed her eyes in concentration.
I can't say I've had much experience in healing dwarves. I hope I can do it.
So do I. Something whirred past Tungdil, just missing his head. Then a third missile rebounded off Goimgar's shield. They heard a high-pitched scream, which stopped abruptly as Jeroen seized his prey. He cast their tormentor into the snow beside them. A yellowy green circle sullied the pristine snow around the diminutive corpse. A head with two long pointed ears plumped beside it. Goimgar shrank back in horror.
Sveit!
The dead crossbowman was Bislapur's former slave. The artisan looked at the mangled gnome and shuddered, then stared at the dent in his shield where the third bolt had struck.
But why would he?
He broke off, not wishing to draw attention to the matter, but Tungdil finished the question for him.
Why would Sveit be aiming at you?
He stared into the gnome's unseeing eyes, but Jeroen's ruthless solution to the problem had ruled out all hope of an answer.
You were travelling with the wrong party, I suppose.
He bent down to pick up the now redundant choker. Sveit was free at last, but not in the way he had hoped. Pensively, he pocketed the collar, intending to confront Bislapur with the evidence when they next met. As he looked down, he noticed a shiny lump of butter-yellow metal.
Gold!
There could be no further doubt that the gnome was responsible for the mishaps that had befallen them on their journey. Bowindil got straight to the point.
Bislapur is the most contemptible dwarf that ever lived!
He wiped the snow furiously from his thick cloak and beard.
Setting his lackey on us and trying to have us killed! Dwarves don't assassinate their kinsfolk! It's the most dastardly crime a child of Rakkas could commit!
The gnome did all his dirty work,
commented Tungdil, his mind still whirring.
Bislapur wasn't going to kill us himself. He would have washed his hands of all responsibility.
Just wait until I get hold of his wretched king,
threatened Boindil, praying to Vrakas to hasten their encounter.
I'm going to beat him black and blue!
Still struggling to digest what had happened, Goimgar shook his head slowly.
No. Gandagar would never have agreed to it. He's not a murderer. Whatever you think. Bislapur must have taken it upon himself to...
The artisan lapsed into a helpless silence, no longer sure what to believe.
Hang on a minute. You want Gandagar to be High King, don't you?
Boindil accused him suspiciously.
Of course I do. I said so from the start. But to murder a dwarf because of it...
He shuddered.
Bislapur must be mad,
he murmured, staring at Bavragor's motionless form.
He must be so desperate for Gandagar to be crowned that he doesn't know what he's doing. He's insane.
Belindis took Bavragor's hand to comfort him. Slowly, the open wound in his neck shriveled until only a small scar was left. Exhausted, Andukai sank down and cooled her face on the snow.
I've healed the wound, she said faintly. In a moment he'll...
Magic,
Bavragor muttered sleepily.
I've been thinking, maybe it's not so useless after all.
Groggily, but with a profoundly serious expression, he nodded to the exhausted Maegar. There was no need for him to thank her in any other way.
A question, if I may, glorious captain of our troop.
The sun was just rising when Radario, shivering with cold but gripping his duffel bag with grim determination, drew alongside Tungdil. The impresario pointed furtively at Jeroen. The events of the previous night had reminded him and the others that the giant was unlikely to be an unusually tall man.
What kind of creature is he?
The question was barely audible through the layers of scarf wrapped around his head.
I have no idea,
Tungdil said frankly, without slowing his pace. Rodario displayed his customary persistence.
No idea? But I thought the lot of you had been traveling together for a while.
She told us that he isn't a monster.
Tungdil suddenly remembered the night in the desert when he had caught a glimpse of what lay behind the terrifying visor. A shiver ran down his spine. The impresario blew on his frozen fingers.
Not a monster, eh? Then what in the name of Palandiel is he? I've never known a human to light up a darkened street with the power of his eyes. If it's a trick, I'd give anything to know the secret. The audience would love it.
Hoping that Rodario would give up and go away, Tungdil said nothing and trudged energetically through the snow, glancing at the map to get his bearings.
Very well. I shall have to assume that he's a creature of Teon.
Looking pretty pleased with himself, Rodario stuck his hands into the pockets of his fur coat.
It adds a bit of drama to the plot. Ye gods, the play will be brilliant. The whole of Gurdlegard will flock to see it.
He stopped and cursed.
I wish my blasted ink would stop freezing. At this rate, I'll have forgotten the best bits before I get a chance to write them down.
You should carry the inkwell next to your skin,
Tungdil advised him. That way the ink will be nice and warm and you can scribble as much as you like. Rodario gave him a friendly pat on the back.
There's a sharp mind hiding under all that hair, my little friend.
I was thinking the same thing, but thank you nonetheless.
Not a single footprint marred the snowy road ahead. The wintry weather and marauding orcs had convinced the people of Tabayin to stay by their hearths and barricade their doors. The terrain was so flat that raiding parties could be spotted well in advance. In clear weather, the watchtowers commanded views of over 100 miles, but no amount of warning could save the settlements from the orcs. The northern hordes could be stopped only by good swordsmen, and Tabayin had precious few of those. Tungdil checked their position against the map. They were closer than ever to the southernmost reaches of the perished land.
Who knows how far the pestilence has spread? There's no way of telling with the landscape blanketed in snow.
Orcs!
Came Boindil's warning from the front of the procession.
20 miles to the west! They're... Hang on! They're turning east!
He reported, surprised.
They're moving fast! You don't think they're looking for us, do you?
Bavrigor pointed to a hamlet situated in the direction that the beasts had been heading originally. The superior vision in his remaining eye enabled him to see what the others could not.
That would have been their next stop, but they've abandoned their quarry.
He wiped the sweat from his forehead. A red glow had settled over his face.
Are you sure you're all right? Belindis asked. You look a bit feverish.
What if it's gangrene? Said Boindil. Maybe the hocus-pocus hasn't worked as well as it should.
The allegation spurred Andokai into action. She asked the mason to lean forward so she could inspect the wound on his neck. Boindil was beside her in a flash. They came to the same conclusion.
The wound has healed nicely, he admitted. I can't argue with that. I've lost a bit of blood, that's all, said Bavrigor,
trying to allay the other's fears. He was obviously uncomfortable at being the center of attention, but Belindis persevered. She pulled off her left glove and laid her hand on his forehead.
For the love of Rakkus, I could forge a horseshoe on there, she said in alarm.
With a skull as thick as his, I don't suppose it would do much harm,
Tungdil joked.
He's a tough customer, our Hammerfist. I'm serious, Tungdil. He's feverish. Either that, or he's got a nasty cold. We need to get him inside before he loses consciousness, or worse.
Don't be ridiculous, objected Bavrigor. I'm perfectly...
He doubled up in a coughing fit that went on and on until he was shaking so violently that his legs caved in. Tungdil pulled him upright and steadied him.
I'd say it's a cold.
Belindis scanned the horizon.
He needs a warm bed for the night.
Tungdil nodded.
We'll stop at the next hamlet. Sorry, old fellow, but a dead mason won't be any good to us.
A cold,
Goimgar chuckled maliciously.
So who's the weakling now? I might not be big, but at least I'm hardy.
He was practically glowing with satisfaction at not being the underdog anymore. Head held high, he strode past the ailing mason with a smug smile that prompted Fergus to throw a snowball in his face. Tungdil soon realized that their efforts to find a bed were destined to fail. There wasn't a single farmhouse, let alone a hamlet, between them and the Grey Range. Since Bavrogor refused to make a detour, they walked without stopping in order to reach the entrance to the tunnels as soon as they could. A nasty surprise awaited them when they finally reached the spot. The mouth of the shaft had transformed itself into a frozen pond.
"We'll have to walk, then,"
said Bavrogor cheerily, doing his best to downplay his illness and seem sprightly despite his fragile state. His bright red face and the beads of perspiration forming beneath his frozen helmet told a different story.
"I can see the range from here."
"The range has been in sight since the moment we entered Tabayin,"
moaned Goimgar, dreading the prospect of another long march in the cold.
"Are you trying to get us all snowblind or something?"
Grumpily, he set off through the snow, the others following in his wake. Toward the evening, they came to a deserted barn filled with bales of hay. They lit a fire in spite of their qualms and made themselves comfortable, then cleared a spot for Bavrogor to lie beside the flames, swaddling him in three blankets so he sweated out the cold. Rodario curled up in the warmth, while Jeroen stood guard by the door, leaving the others free to look after the invalid. They clustered around him.
"It's nothing, honestly."
Just then he choked and spat out a large clot of blood. He was gasping for air, groaning rather than breathing, and he seemed to be losing strength. The warmth was making things worse.
"If you give me a sip of brandy, I'll be fighting fate." "It can't be a cold,"
Boindel said firmly. He got up.
"It's gangrene, I know it. Sometimes it spreads beneath the skin, even after the wound has healed."
"No, Boindel," snapped Andokai. "I cleaned the flesh thoroughly." A terrible thought occurred to Tungdil. He got up, went over to Goimgar, and picked up his shield to examine the dent. Where the bolt had hit, the metal was discolored, and there were traces of a clear, frozen liquid that neither he nor the artisan had noticed before. His spirits sank. The bolt had been dipped in something that had stuck to the shield.
"Fracas, give him strength."
"Do you have a spell against poison?"
he asked Andokai hoarsely.
By the look of things, Sverd wasn't relying purely on his aim.
"Poison?"
Bavrogor swallowed his cough and grinned. As his lips parted, his companion saw the blood leaking from his gums and coloring his teeth. His mouth was full of blood.
"I knew it! Did you hear that, Goimgar? What's the betting you'd be dead already? I've drunk enough brandy and beer in my lifetime to toughen me up. Ha! A cold!"
The Maga closed her eyes. "I can't do anything against poison. My art is... I'm afraid it's not my kind of magic," she said in a soft, apologetic tone. "Healing the wound drained a lot of my energy. My strength is all but exhausted."
A terrible silence settled over the group. There was no mistaking what Andokai's words meant for the mason. Belindis reached for his calloused hand and squeezed it encouragingly. She was too choked to speak.
"I know what you're thinking," croaked Bavrogor at length. "Things don't look good for the merry minstrel. It's all right. I wasn't intending to return from the mission anyway."
He looked up at Tungdil.
"Still, I'd give anything to see the Fifthling Kingdom and fashion Keenfire's spurs. I wanted to go out with a bang, not in a dingy barn miles away from my beloved mountains."
Blood was seeping through his pores, the droplets merging into rivulets and soaking his straw mattress. In no time, his garments were drenched with red.
"You're not going to die,"
Tungdil told him shakily. His smile, which he hoped would be encouraging, looked more like a grimace.
"We can't fashion Keenfire without you. You're Beroine's best mason."
Bavrogor had to swallow a mouthful of blood before he could reply.
"In that case, you'll have to take me with you. We'll make the axe to kill Nadon. You'll see."
He nodded to the door.
"Carry me to the Perished Land. I'll fulfill my mission after my death." But... "You'll be a revenant,"
stuttered Boindil, horrified.
"Your soul!" "I'll do my bit for Keenfire, and confound the rest."
The outburst ended in another coughing fit.
What if you turn against us? The other dead souls tried to kill us and eat us.
Bowindel glanced at the others for support. Some were struggling with their emotions. The remainder looked embarrassed.
Chain my hands together if you're worried, the mason told them. My will is stronger than the drive to do evil. Dwarves are too stubborn to be conquered by darkness.
He closed his eyes.
You'll have to hurry,
he gasped. He coughed again, and blood spewed from his mouth, trickling into his well-kempt beard.
Jeroen!
At Andokai's bidding, the giant stooped to lift the dwarf. Cradling Bavrigor gently in his arms, like a mother would carry her child, he left the barn and stomped through the snow. His long, tireless limbs bore the mason toward the north, where the perished land had established its dominion, awakening anything that died to hideous life. The rest of the company packed their things and followed the giant as fast as the sparkling snow and the dwarves' stumpy legs would allow. Tungdil looked up at the stars and wept silent tears for the mason, who was sacrificing his soul for the sake of the axe on which Gerdlegard's future depended. For all Bavrigor's eccentricities and occasional crotchetiness, he was a good dwarf whom Tungdil regarded as a friend. He heard a sniff beside him and turned to the tearful Belindis. Her eyes were red with crying, but she smiled and squeezed his hand. Suddenly his courage, which had all but deserted him in the barn, came flooding back. So much had happened since they had left the Secondling Kingdom, too much, in fact. Their adventure had turned into something far bigger and more perilous than they'd ever imagined. Even Rodario, renowned for his pompous comments, had fallen silent and was brooding over the mason's death.
I hope Gerdlegard is worth it, Vrakas, murmured Tungdil, gazing up at the sparkling firmament. When all this is over, I shall see to it that our folks don't barricade themselves back in their mountains. From now on, we'll work together.
Belindis gave his hand another squeeze, but he pulled away and hurried to join Bowindel at the head of the procession. It was the wrong time to be thinking of anything except Keenfire.
You like her, don't you?
The Secondling said immediately, without glancing round.
Don't start, Tungdil told him. It's the last thing I want to talk about.
I can't say I blame you. She's an attractive lass, and to someone like you, with no experience of the fairer sex, she must look as pretty as Vrak as his own daughter.
I've decided not to think about it until Nadon has been defeated. My duty is to Gerdlegard.
Trust a scholar to want to think about it.
Bowindel took care not to meet his eye. For all intents and purposes, he was addressing Jeroen's snowy footprints.
Think about it if you must, but remember, if something is worth pursuing, you shouldn't waste time. Situations change faster than you can split an orcish skull, and a moment's hesitation could cost you your chance.
What makes you say that?
No reason.
He peered into the distance.
They're up ahead.
He whipped out his axes.
Let's hope the drunkard can defy the bidding of the perished land.
It was evident from his hefted weapons that he was prepared to take decisive action. The Maegar called out to Jeroen, who raised his armored hand and beckoned them over. At his side was Bavrigor, arms dangling limply and gaze fixed blankly on the grey range.
Bavrigor?
Tungdil said gently, searching the pale face for a trace of recognition. His features had aged terribly. He looked waxen and corpse-like.
I feel nothing,
came the ponderous response. It seemed to cost him a great deal of effort to open his mouth and form the words.
I can't feel my body. My mind is empty.
The soulless eyes roved over the group and settled on Tungdil.
It feels bad. Everything feels bad. Things I loved, I hate. Things I hated.
He stared past Tungdil and fixed his gaze on Bowindel.
I want to slaughter the things I hated, tear them apart and devour them, tie my hands together. I don't know how much longer I can resist. The evil is inside me.
Very well,
said Tungdil, unthreading the leather strap from Goimgar's shield. He bound Bavrigor's hands behind his back.
Tighter,
growled the mason.
You don't have to worry about my blood flow. My heart stopped beating when I died.
He seemed tense and agitated, but once the bonds had been tightened to his satisfaction, he relaxed a little and turned to Tungdil.
I want you to behead me as soon as my work is done. I don't want to serve the perished land for eternity and patrol the abandoned fifthling galleries, massacring innocents and spreading the pestilence.
No dwarf will ever serve the perished land, Tungdil promised. You have my word.
As for you,
the mason snapped at Boindil,
take my advice and stay away. I want nothing better than to sink my teeth into your gullet and tear you to shreds.
He squared his shoulders, and his chestnut eye glimmered cruelly before he looked down and stared at the snow. He took a first step, then another.
Hurry! I don't want to be a soulless corpse for a moment longer than necessary.
On a signal from the Maegar, Jerun assumed the role of Bavragor's keeper, walking close behind him so the others were shielded from his jaws by a solid metal frame. Time wore on, orbit after orbit, as they trudged across the never-ending flats of Tabayin. The breadbasket, as the fertile fields were nicknamed in summer, was so inhospitably cold that it was essential to keep moving in order not to freeze. Tungdil had read somewhere that light reflected by the snow could harm the eyes and cause permanent damage. To protect his companions from blindness, he ordered them to bind cloth around their faces and look out through tiny slits. Their journey was slow and laborious. The only members of the company who didn't seem to mind the march were Jerun and the undead mason, who ploughed their way impassively through the snow. Since their provisions were frozen solid, they had the onerous task of thawing their food by the fire every evening before they could eat. Without the warm garments given to them by Xantus, they would surely have perished in the cold. At length, Boindil became more restless, his fighting instincts ever harder to repress, while Bavragor had been stripped of the very things that made him who he was. He didn't drink, didn't sing, didn't laugh, just stared into the distance. On one occasion, he took the edge off his hunger with a mountain hare. Ripping it from a metal trap, he ate it alive, leaving nothing but bones and fur. The sound of his frenzied eating and the cracking of bones made Goimgar, whose hand rested permanently on his sword, more nervous than ever. The grey range edged closer and closer. Its peaks seemed almost in touching distance, yet still they struggled through the snowdrifts of Tabayin, finally crossing the border into Garugar, and after an exhausting march of many orbits, reaching the slate-grey foothills of the range. On their way, they encountered neither orcs nor any other beasts, although they occasionally saw their tracks. Great armies were advancing southward, but fortunately for the company, their paths never crossed. At last they neared the stronghold's outermost defences. Even from a distance they could see that no one had been posted to defend the ramparts against intruders from Girdlegard's interior. The beasts from the north had torn stone from stone, destroying walls and toppling towers until nothing remained of the stronghold's former splendor. Their work had been done so thoroughly that Tungdil and the others were hard-pressed to imagine how the kingdom had looked during Giselbert Ironeye's era. Fragments of stonework testified to the fifthling mason's skill, but the glorious ramparts were nothing but ruins. It was a harrowing sight for the dwarves. Although the defenses seemed deserted, the company approached the gates with caution.
Stay here, and don't make a sound,
Boindil told them as they struggled to the top of a steep pathway.
Nalmora and I will check for sentries.
The pair slipped away, darting between the grey rocks and hiding behind sections of masonry that loomed out of the snow. Their goal was an open gateway, as tall as a house, leading straight inside the mountain. Tungdil scanned their surroundings and listened intently. A chill wind whistled through the cracked ramparts, producing high-pitched notes that rolled together in a tune. Icicles hung like glassy stalactites from the mountain ledges, and 50 paces to their left, a waterfall had stopped midstream in a frozen sculpture of ice. No orcs, no ogres, no Alfar, nothing.
Did you hear what he said?
Goimgar smiled bitterly.
He told us to be quiet, if only he could hear himself.
He's not exactly graceful, agreed the impresario, although the comparison with the delightful Narmora certainly doesn't help.
Tungdil watched as they stole forward, Boindil relying on his diminutive size while the half-elf sprang between the rocks with the elegance of a dancer. There were no telltale noises from the snow beneath her feet. She seemed barely to land at all, skimming across the ground as light as a feather. Bowindel's chainmail, by contrast, made a terrible racket, even through his thick fur coat. Narmora was the first to reach the gate. She pressed herself against the wall, listening intently to the darkness before slipping inside. Her silhouette melted into the gloom, and she disappeared from sight. Fergus fiddled determinedly with his gloves.
"Sometimes I wish she wasn't so daring," he whispered.
"Don't worry, old chap,"
Rodario soothed him. "Narmora is a woman who knows her talents and isn't afraid to use them. You know the sort of thing she got up to before the three of us were a troop? This is child's play by comparison."
"I'd rather not talk about Narmora," Goimgar chipped in hurriedly. "She's scary enough as it is."
Bowindel had also reached the gates to the Fifthling Kingdom, conquered over 1,000 cycles earlier by the Perished Land. He stopped, apparently undecided, and looked about, but the coast was clear. At that moment, Narmora emerged from the enormous tunnel. The black shadows stuck to her like cobwebs, wrapping themselves around her lovingly, reluctant to set her free. She waved to them, her relaxed manner signaling that there was nothing to fear.
"How did she do that?"
Goimgar whispered nervously.
"It was like she was covered in ink."
"Half magic," came the Maegar's answer. "It's something she was born with. Alphar are children of darkness."
"She'll swap sides as soon as we meet any of her kind,"
Goimgar predicted darkly.
"Blood is thicker than water."
"And love is stronger than both,"
Fergus countered firmly.
"Narmora would rather die than betray me, and I'd give my life to protect her from harm."
The puny dwarf grumbled unintelligibly and followed the others to the gateway. He held his shield in front of him, ready to ward off an attack.
"All clear," said Narmora, not bothering to lower her voice. "They seem to have contented themselves with knocking down the defences and vandalising the gates, to the point where they can't be closed." "So where are all the runts?"
demanded Bowindil, whirling his axes over his head.
"At the stone gateway, I expect. And for our sake, I hope they stay there," said Tungdil,
who remembered the stronghold's layout from a book he'd once read. He turned to the archway.
"Time to relight the great furnace of dragonfire."
It was with reverence, apprehension, and a good deal of emotion that he took his first careful step into the tunnel, knowing that no dwarf had set foot in the stronghold since the Fifthling's defeat. Life flooded back to the kingdom as Rodario and Fergus lit their lamps. The walls reflected the light so radiantly that they hastily damped the flames. At last they could see that they were standing in a passageway whose walls were clad with polished palladium. 1,000 cycles of neglect had done nothing to subdue the metal's white sheen. The likeness of dwarven kings had been etched into the polished panels, and a row of bearded rulers gazed benevolently at the visitors, their shiny red axes of cast vracassium raised in greeting.
"Such majesty," murmured Rodario.
Filled with wonderment, the dwarves sank to their knees and prayed to Vracas. Even the soulless Bavragor was awed by his surroundings, but every word of his prayer was uttered with immense concentration, as the evil within him strove to break his will and seize control of his thoughts and beliefs. It hadn't reckoned with his resolve and the legendary stubbornness of the dwarven mind. Andokai, Jerun, and the players waited patiently. At length, Tungdil rose and breathed deeply. The passageway smelled old, dusty, and venerable. It had retained its character in spite of the invasion of orcs and other beasts.
"We'll have to do some exploring if we're going to find Flamemere."
He set off with Bowindel at his side. Their boots raised clouds of dust, and from time to time a small creature scurried to safety. The ground was littered with fragments of bone, shields, and mail. They proceeded in silence until they reached a second archway. The door had been ripped from its hinges, allowing them to enter the many-columned hall. Leading out from the vast pentagonal chamber were 15 passageways. The stone signposts had been smashed to smithereens.
"There's such a thing as too much choice," Rodario said glumly, "especially when we haven't got all day to scamper around like mice until we find the right tunnel."
"We could pick the one with the least footprints," proposed Tungdil. "I can't imagine orcs are frequent visitors to Flamemere.
There's no reason for them to go there.
Good idea,
agreed Boindil, making a beeline for one of the passageways. Narmora, Jeroen, and Andokai set about inspecting the others, while the rest of the company found a less exposed corner of the hall to sit and rest. Rodario scribbled a few thoughts, then shared a meal with Fergus, while Bavrogor stayed standing and stared emptily ahead. Goimgar took shelter behind his shield, chewing nervously on a strip of cured meat and scanning the room for threats. The thought of 15 passageways converging on his resting place did nothing to help him relax.
He must be wondering what's happened to Gandogar, Belindis said softly to Tungdil. He's not the only one. We've come all this way and no one said anything about another group of dwarves. Your folk hadn't seen him either. I hope nothing dreadful's happened, he said, concerned.
He closed his eyes, only to open them suddenly and unbutton his fur coat. It was much warmer in the hall than outside, and the heat was making him tired.
Get some sleep, Belindis told him. I'll keep watch and wake you as soon as there's anything to report. I'm your leader. I'm not supposed to sleep. Tired leaders make mistakes, she said firmly, pushing on his shoulders until he capitulated and lay down. There, that's much better. Now you can dream of rescuing our kingdoms.
Smiling, she pushed a wayward lock of hair behind her ear and turned to get a better view of the hall. Sitting next to him like that, her gaze watchful and one hand resting confidently on her axe, she looked every inch the warrior.
It's definitely this way.
To nobody's great surprise, Boindil, his mind made up, had no intention of listening to anyone else.
Fine, said Tungdil, signaling for them to start moving. We'll start with this one, and if it doesn't work out, we'll try Andokai's next.
They had snatched a few moments' sleep to recover their strength in preparation for facing the dragon, but now it was time to move on.
Argimas is the mate of Brambusil, Tungdil explained to Belindis. Brambusil lived in the Grey Range until Giselbert's folk stole his fire, killed him, and plundered his lair. Argimas fled to Flamemere.
Never to be seen again, Goimgar finished gladly. Let's hope the fire breather stays there. I can't say I'm particularly convinced by our strategy. Dragon's scales are as hard as steel.
We don't need to kill her, only to steal her fire, said Andokai, unconcerned. I thought you'd be happy about that.
Happy?
Chimed in Boindil.
It's a waste. Why do we have to let her live? Argimas is the biggest beast in Gurlagard, or thereabouts, and I'm not allowed to kill her.
From the injured look on his face, it was obvious that the warrior felt cruelly misunderstood. He tried again.
Name me one other place where I can find a real dragon. It would be scandalous to pass up an opportunity like this.
I'm afraid the estimable Mega is right, said Rodario.
That's exactly the kind of reaction I'd expect from a coward like you,
Boindil told him dismissively.
Belindis, what do you say, the two of us?
Quiet, cautioned Tungdil.
There was a smell of sulfur in the air, and the temperature was rising. Their route had taken them down countless flights of stairs and through endless shafts, and now at last they were closing in.
Not another word until we know what's out there. We don't want Argimas leaving her lava bath until we're absolutely ready.
Goimgar shrank behind his shield.
Maybe we should ask her to help. Dragons aren't stupid, you know, and she might be quite reasonable.
You can't ask the dragon to give us her fire,
Boindil blazed up angrily.
Are you determined to ruin everything? You've got to take it! Take it, do you hear?
Goimgar, Argimas's mate was killed by dwarves. I hardly think she'll be willing to help us, said Tungdil, shaking his head. Our priority is to stay alive, so we'll settle for stealing her fire.
He patted the stash of torches on his belt.
We need to bait her, nothing more.
Unbelievable, grumbled Boindil. Why does everyone have to spoil my fun?
They stepped out of the passageway and were bathed in an intense yellow glare. There was a pervading smell of rotten eggs, and it was difficult to breathe, but the view made up for the other unpleasantness. A wave of heat rose toward them as they approached the seething lake. The molten lava was alive with bubbles, some swelling and showering incandescent droplets as they burst, others collapsing meekly, while new pockets formed on the surface in a boiling, churning mass.
Tungdil couldn't be sure of the lake's exact proportions, but the expanse of simmering lava measured at least 4,000 paces across. Islands of solid rock rose above the surface, and strange basalt columns hung from the cavern's ceiling, where cycle after cycle of spitting magma had cooled. Everything was suffused with the lake's yellow glow.
"Is that where the dragon lives?"
asked Goimgar, who was staring with the others in amazement.
"Thank goodness we're not going to fight her. Any creature tough enough to survive in that inferno won't be slain by our blades."
Jeroen raised his sword to direct his mistress's attention to something 1,000 paces farther along the shore.
"You can stop worrying about Argamas," said Andokai. "Take a look over there."
To their horror, they saw a gigantic skeleton, which, judging by its size and shape, was all that was left of Brandbasil's mate.
Chapter 7. Giselbert's Folk, Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Winter, 6,234th Solar Cycle. Boindil prodded the enormous skeleton with his boot. Broken arrow shafts, lances, spears, and smaller bones lay in and around the dragon's remains.
"Orcs! From the look of the bones, they killed it a good few cycles ago."
He appraised the fossil critically, and a look of distant longing passed over his face.
"What a fight it must have been."
Goimgar snorted and shrugged.
"We're wasting our time here. We may as well go home. I don't know about you, but I'd like to be in my own kingdom with my own clansfolk when Nadon comes banging on the gates."
"A fat lot of use you'd be," Boindil said scornfully. "You can't even fight."
He gave one of the ribs an experimental kick. The bones stood firm.
"I didn't say anything about fighting,"
Goimgar corrected him.
"If we're all going to die, I'd rather be back in my kingdom, that's all. I don't want to meet my end in the company of an axe-happy lunatic, an imposter, and an undead drunk."
He glanced at the smith.
"No offence, Belindis. I've got nothing against you."
"Couldn't we light the furnace with ordinary fire?"
asked Fergus.
Tungdil looked out across the lava.
"We may as well give it a shot. It's better than giving up and doing nothing while Nadon lays waste to Girdlegard. We don't stand a chance of stopping him otherwise."
He wiped the sweat from his eyes and peered at the tongues of fire licking across the lake. He had seen flames of all kinds and colours in his smithy, but these looked somehow different.
"Is it my imagination?" he said to Belindis, who was similarly knowledgeable when it came to fire. "Or are those flames unusually bright?"
"They're unusually bright," she said, guessing his thoughts.
She pulled out a torch and held the end above the twisting flames. The wood flared up with incredible intensity.
"Perhaps you could put it out for us, Namora," said the Maegar.
The half-elf nodded and focused her mind. Her eyes closed and opened again a moment later, but the torch was still alight.
"I can't do it," she said, surprised. "Normally it's no..."
"Precisely."
The Maegar laughed in relief.
"There's your proof, Tungdil. Argamas left her fiery legacy in the lake."
The excitement was too much for Belindis, who planted an exuberant kiss on Tungdil's cheek. He smiled shyly.
"In that case, we've got what we came for," he declared. "We'll light the torches and get going. The Fifthling's furnace is waiting to be kindled back to life."
With that, he set off toward the mouth of the tunnel.
"Bravo, bravo!" gushed Rodario. "Thank goodness it's so warm down here. My ink has never flown so freely. Such emotion, such excitement. The scene is positively begging to be recorded in my notes."
He was still scribbling furiously as he walked.
"Fergus, my dear friend and worthy associate, the sheer scale of this adventure will soon exceed the limits of any conventional play. We could open our doors in the morning," he suggested. "Hire some extras, double the ticket price. What do you think?"
Fergus took one last look at Flamemere before commencing the ascent through the passageway.
"We should probably leave out the lava," he ruled. "We won't be able to afford enough coal to simulate the heat."
"Good thinking. We need to be careful with the costs. Besides, we can't have our valued spectators vomiting because of the smell."
"They'll vomit anyway if they have to put up with your acting,"
said Boindil, handing him a torch.
"Take this. Since you won't be fighting, you may as well make yourself useful. And woe betide you if you let it go out.
I swear by all four winds and every conceivable divinity, even the evil ones, that if, in spite of my best efforts and the intervention of all the relevant weather systems and supernatural powers, I was to suffer such a mishap, then I would, no matter what the circumstances or the extent of my guilt, lay the blame fair and square at your door.
Boindel, who had been nodding in satisfaction, stopped short.
Very funny,
he growled as Rodario and Goengar fell about laughing.
I'll wipe the smiles from your faces.
Bavragor's behavior had become increasingly erratic. Since entering the Fifthling Kingdom, he hadn't said a word, his one eye rolling wildly as he walked. Every now and then he growled or groaned for no apparent reason, and the leather strap around his wrists tightened with a menacing snap. Jeroen maintained a safe distance between him and the others. Meanwhile, Boindil was unhappy about the light from the torches, which he said drew attention to their presence and played into the enemy's hands. But no one could think of a workable alternative. He was right, though. The fierce flames lit up the passageways, the panels of vracassium, palladium, gold and silver, gleaming with light, rendering even the smallest details visible from a distance of 20 paces and making the company equally easy to spot. Tungdil ran a hand over the panels. They must have known we'd be in need of precious metals. At the risk of angering the dead fifthlings, he decided to break off sections of the portraits for use in making the axe. Jeroen snapped the metal with ease, and soon they had enough of each material for the inlay. All that was missing was the iron for the blade. He glanced at the axe that Lot Ionan had given to him.
I could smelt it, I suppose.
The company had been marching through the Lost Kingdom for some time when Boindel signalled for them to stop.
There's something ahead, he said, tensing in anticipation. Beasts of some kind, but not orcs.
Tungdil sniffed the air and detected the odour too.
They're in front of us.
He turned to Namora, who nodded briefly and set off to investigate.
Come here, you cowards!
Thundered a deep voice from somewhere along the passageway.
It takes more than that to scare a dwarf!
A moment later, blades crashed against shields and high-pitched squeals rent the air.
I may be the last one standing, but I'll slay at least 4 dozen of you before you cut me down. Vrakas is with me!
I know that voice,
thought Tungdil. He was still trying to place it when someone got there first.
King Gendagar!
Shouted a jubilant Goimgar.
Stand firm, your majesty! I'm on my way!
Discarding his heavy cloak, he grabbed his shield, whipped his sword from its sheath, and stormed forth.
Such courage! Exclaimed Rodario. What's got into old Shimmerbeard? I never thought he had it in him.
Me neither, said Boindel. All the same, we shouldn't let him fight alone.
The prospect of clashing blades with Teon's beasts filled him with visible euphoria.
As for you,
he threatened, nodding at Jeroen,
you know the rules. Keep an eye on our undead mason. I don't want him stabbing me in the back.
He threw off his cumbersome cloak and looked expectantly at Tungdil. The company's leader hefted his axe, having already decided that the Fourthling monarch deserved their aid.
Stand by our rivals like true children of the smith, he told them, preparing to charge. Death to our enemies!
They barreled along the corridor and found themselves in a small, dimly lit hall filled with hairy, hunchbacked Bognilim. Clad in armor several sizes too big for them and wielding maces and notched swords, the squawking creatures were shoving their way up a stone staircase, at the top of which towered a statue of Vrakas cast in gold. Blocking their path was Gandagar, as godlike in his heavy armor as the sculpture he was protecting. Gripping his double-bladed axe with both hands, he mowed down the first wave of aggressors with a single swipe. His diamond-studded helmet showered the walls and pillars with dappled light, adding to his heavenly aura. At the bottom of the steps lay dead or dying beasts that had fallen from a height of 10 paces. The stairs dripped with slimy olive and bottle-green blood, which further hindered the Bognilim's attack. Yet the enemy showed no sign of retreating. Pushing and shoving, the beasts fought their way to the front, only to be cut down by Gandagar's swooping blade. Bowindil raced ahead of his companions, sounding his bugle to herald their advance.
"Here's another dwarf who's not afraid of Teon's beasts!"
Laughing maniacally, he threw himself into the battle, becoming Ironheart the Furious, from whom there was no escape. His axes seemed to seek out his enemies instinctively, zeroing in on unprotected flesh and damaged mail. At the end of his first sally, 6 Bognilim lay twitching on the floor. Ironheart powered on, channeling a path through the hordes, with Tungdil and the others following in his wake. Even the usually timorous Goimgar launched himself into the battle. For the first time, he was prepared to fight and even die. During the commotion, Bavrigor succeeded in tearing off his leather manacles. Not possessing any weapons, he tore the creatures apart with his hands, thrusting his blood-smeared muscular fingers deep into their flesh to inflict the fatal wound. The Bognilim fought back with their swords, but the Revenant continued undeterred, stopping only to seize 2 maces and swing them with terrible strength. Stooping low, Jerun swiped at the knee-high creatures with his club. They crashed down amid their comrades, squashing some of them with their weight.
"To the stairs!"
bellowed Tungdil, on seeing that Gandagar was overextended. The king seemed to be the only survivor among his group. None of the others were visible amid the mass of heaving bodies. The company closed ranks to thrash their way forward. Jerun stayed at the foot of the steps and repelled the advancing Bognilim with murderous force, while the others worked their way up, engaging their enemy from behind until the last beast on the stairs had fallen. The ruler of the Fourthling Kingdom stood before them on the steps. Gandagar looked dreadful, his face pale, haggard and drawn. A mighty weapon had left 2 deep gashes in his bloodied chainmail.
"My king!"
Goimgar said joyfully. Not even the present danger could prevent him from sinking to 1 knee. Tungdil gave him a brief nod.
"Where are the others?"
"Dead,"
he said, struggling to regain his composure.
"We need to get out of here before."
5 figures, broader, uglier and nastier than orcs, appeared at the far end of the hall. They were 4 paces tall and looked incredibly strong.
"Ogres!"
Bowindil clapped excitedly.
"This is where it gets really fun. Hey, Armorface, I'm leaving the tiddlers to you."
He knocked the butts of his axes together and licked his lips.
"This is more like it."
The smaller beasts drew back without a murmur, allowing the ogres to pass.
"The rest of you run," commanded Andokai. "Jerun and I will keep them busy. We'll see how far my remaining magic gets us. Go!"
Even as she lowered her sword and began the incantation, a thunderous rumble filled the hall, and a giant tore itself out of the flesh of the mountain, taking shape beside the statue. Cavernous eyes stared at the Maegor from a long, stony face, and a fist sped down toward her. Andokai spotted the danger just in time and diverted her magic toward the unexpected foe. She managed to stop the blow, but was brought to her knees by the effort.
"A golem!"
she coughed.
"There must be a wizard controlling it. Find him and kill him, before my strength deserts me. I can't hold off the creature for long."
A great cry went up among the surviving Bognilim when they saw their apparently invincible enemies struggling to repel the new threat. The squawking and shouting grew louder, until the creatures resolved to try their luck again, advancing in a wave of arms, legs, teeth, and whirling weapons. The onslaught of Bognilim drove Jerun slowly up the stairway, until he stopped and opened his visor, steeping his assailants in a beam of purple light. The hall echoed with his terrible, menacing roar, and the whimpering Bognilim fled from the armored giant. Jerun followed them, lashing out with his sword and mace to regain the lost ground.
"He's over there!"
Namora pointed to a man-sized figure in the malachite robes of Nodon school. He was standing 100 paces away, flanked by a mob of muscular orcs who served as his bodyguards. It was clear from his gestures that he was responsible for steering the golem's attack.
"They're determined not to let us near the furnace," said Tungdil.
"Nadon doesn't want us to forge Keenfire. We're on the right track."
Gandagar looked at the swelling ranks of beasts that were piling into the hall,
It's hopeless. The door to the furnace is on the far side of the adjoining hall. It's sealed with dwarven runes, so the beasts can't get in. We were almost inside when they ambushed us. They must have known we were coming.
Tungdil's mind whirred feverishly. Everyone with a role to play in forging Keenfire needs to make it through that door. You or I will go with them. Since I never intended to be crowned High King, I cede my place to you, King Gandagar. My only concern is the safety of Girdlegard and our kinsfolk. He looked his rival in the eye. Narmora will explain her role in this later, but I need you to promise you'll do everything you can to help her slay the Magus. Gandagar bowed his head.
I swear, in the name of Rakkas, our creator, and by the memory of Giselbert Ironeye, founding father of this kingdom, that I shall fight the Magus to the end.
They shook hands.
Which doesn't mean to say you won't be there too, he added.
They turned to face the enemy and raised their weapons. Tungdil placed the bugle to his lips and sounded the attack. Giselbert's folk, Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. Jerun led the advance, flanked by the dwarves, with Rodario, torches in both hands, following close behind, shielded by Fergus, who was doing his best to fend off the Bognilim and protect the precious flames. Back on the steps, Andukai was still under siege from the Golem. All her efforts were focused on defending herself, leaving her no time to deal with the Famulus and stop the attack at its source.
Hurry! She shouted hoarsely. Another couple of charms, and my magic will be spent!
Leave it to me,
volunteered Narmora. Launching herself into the air, she alighted on Jerun's shoulders and pushed off again, soaring another 5 paces to land on a Bognil's head. In no time, she was away again, using the heads and shoulders of the bewildered beasts as stepping stones. She had almost reached the Famulus when a dagger nicked her calf. She missed her step and fell among the howling brutes.
Narmora!
Cried Fergus, so overcome with horror that he neglected his duty as Rodario's guard. In a flash, the beast surged forward and closed in on the impresario.
Shoo!
He shouted, thrusting the torches in their direction. Squealing, the Bognilim backed away from the tongues of fire, only to be struck by flying sparks. In an instant, they were reeling backward, consumed by flames. The dragonfire burned them to ashes before they had time to retreat. Rodario's strategy guaranteed his own safety, but at the cost of the torches, whose light was ebbing after numerous brushes with the Bognilim's swords. At length, he was left with a single torch.
Fergus!
He shouted, trying to alert his companion to his plight.
Fergus, I need your help!
But Fergus was still staring anxiously at the spot where Narmora had fallen.
For the love of Rakkas, wake up!
Belindis scolded him. She fought her way through the fray and thrust herself between the Bognilim and the impresario. All of a sudden, Narmora appeared out of nowhere, looming up behind the Famulus's bodyguards and hewing the first orc's head with a mighty blow. She dispatched the other beasts before they had time to respond.
Very impressive,
the Famulus said furiously, pointing his staff in her direction.
But not as effective as this.
A thick bolt of light shot toward Narmora, who darted nimbly aside. The bolt latched onto her movement. Just as it seemed certain that Narmora would be hit, the bolt struck an invisible obstacle and dissipated harmlessly. It was instantly followed by a powerful flash of lightning that arced toward the Famulus from the direction of the statue. There was a terrible crackle as it seared through his flesh, the flames subsiding only when nothing remained but a pile of reeking cinders. The next moment, the golem collapsed. Huge chunks of rock rained down on the enemy troops, squashing dozens of Bognilim and flattening 3 of the ogres who were too ponderous to escape. The 2 remaining ogres stopped in their tracks and stared fearfully at the triumphant Maegor before retreating into the adjoining hall and vanishing from sight. Narmora gave Andukai a wave, and the Maegor returned the greeting, then drew her sword in a single fluid movement. It was the only defense she had left.
Excellent, excellent! So Namora's still alive! Unless there's another lead actor you'd rather work with, you might want to lend me a hand,
the impresario said to Fergus. At this rate, the fabulous Rodario will die a heroic death. Andokai abandoned the statue and stormed down the staircase, her blade wreaking havoc among the enemy troops.
She always ruins everything,
Boindil said testily.
I was looking forward to those ogres.
He threw himself with added fury on the fleeing Bognalim.
At least I can have some fun with you!
Disregarding Tungdil's warnings, Boindil chased after his victims, slicing into their necks from behind and shooing them along as if he were herding pigs. On reaching the doorway to the adjacent hall, he came to a sudden halt.
What's wrong? Don't tell me your brain's caught up with you!
Goimgar said spitefully, hurrying with the others to join him. They stopped and froze as well.
I say we leave this scene out of the play,
Rodario whispered hoarsely.
I have a feeling we won't enjoy it.
The hall was at least 3,000 paces long and 2,000 paces wide. It was obvious what purpose the chamber had once served, for among the disused blast furnaces, ramps, and rope pulleys lay abandoned slag heaps and scattered mounds of pig iron and coal. Now, 1,000 orcs, Bognalim, and trolls occupied the Fifthling's smelting works, sealing the entry to the Dragonfire furnace. The defeated ogres and Bognalim had already reached the foremost line of beasts and were hastily relaying what had happened in the adjoining hall. An angry murmur swept through the chamber as the beasts drew their weapons, growling in readiness for the fight.
It's...
Boindil was lost for words. He lowered his axes in an admission of defeat. The vast army was more than just another of the big challenges that he was so fond of. Even he could see that the odds were stacked overwhelmingly against the plucky band.
Do you think you could fly to the other side and take us with you like you did for Goimgar?
Tungdil whispered to the Maegar.
The battle with the Golem and his master drained my last reserves of magic. There's nothing left.
Andokai's eyes scanned the crowds bitterly.
Had I known what awaited us, I would have held back, but even then...
Let's go home,
Goimgar implored them. He turned to Gandagar.
Your Majesty!
He stopped short, silenced by a look from Tungdil.
We can't go home now, he said. We'll get to the furnace or die trying.
He squared his shoulders stubbornly.
We're Gerdlegard's last line of resistance. No one else is going to make it past this hall.
Then it's decided.
To Goimgar's horror, Gandagar gave